Lucy Parsons, Sylvia Mendes, and Elvira Arellano are just three of many women highlighted in Elizabeth Betita Martinez's new book, 500 Years of Chicana Women's History. In this groundbreaking bilingual text, the story of the Chicana in struggle is highlighted like never before through hundreds of photographs and other powerful images. 500 Years of Chicana Women's History chronologically educates readers about the contributions of Chicanas from the time before the Spanish invasion of Mexico to the historic immigration marches of today. Influential playwright and author Sherry Moraga has said of this book, "In these pages, La Chicana emerges from historical erasure as spirit warrior, artist, and revolucionaria." In the 83-year-old Elizabeth Betita Martinez has been participating in movements for social justice since the early 1950s as a Chicana feminist, activist, scholar, and author of numerous books. In 2005, she was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Uprising producer Gabriel San Roman had a conversation with her yesterday.
Mexicanas who came here had to build new traditions of resistance, but not without a sense of the past. Thanks to their mothers and the ongoing experience of a hard life with bitter poverty and patriarchal oppression. Now we had a new enemy, too. Across the Southwest and beyond, we constantly encountered racism, beginning in primary school, where teachers slapped us for speaking a few words of Spanish or called us, quote, dirty Mexicans. Like the other American rebels, some hundreds of us joined the Communist Party, the CPUSA, in the 1930s and 40s, were active in unions, went on strike, sometimes in the thousands, for decent wages and respect. Chicana participation as communists is not easy to unravel because of the red baiting that continues today, but you will find it here in some amazing women. When the Chicana movement began, we saw Chicanas and others in New Mexico working to get back land lost with the 1846-48 U.S. War on Mexico, thousands walking out of high school to protest the racism, and many putting on brown berets to defend their communities. We joined the United Farm Workers as campesinas and boycott supporters. Thousands of us marched against the Vietnam War on August 29, 1970, only to be chased and struck down by tear-gassing police, who also killed three Chicanos that day. The fight for the right of migrant workers has brought more heroines. New writers have been emerging across the land, telling the truth with strong new voices, while our music, theater, poetry, dancing, and all forms of art affirm us culturally in both traditional and new ways. Lesbian, bisexual, and transgender women have affirmed their presence as individuals and in organizations. It becomes so clear that we did not learn our feminism from European American women.
Now, Betita, that was from your introduction to this brand new book that you've written called 500 Years of Chicana History, Women's History. And what was your inspiration for writing this book?
I think I knew that we had to do something special for women, even more so than for Chicanos in general, because the women were even more invisibilized, even more buried, their histories, their existence was even less known than the two together. So I thought, let's do it. Okay. And I started on that, and it was an amazing confirmation of that, because the first book, the 500 Years of Chicano History, that took about a year to do, to collect the pictures and put them together and write the text and da-da-da. This book took 7 years because the women were so hard to find. The pictures, there's 800 pictures of women in this book, but I can't tell you what it took to collect them because they were so hard to find. They just weren't anywhere in the history books. In fact, you'll find very few women, I think, in this book in anybody else's history. There's a few, you know, but if they're not Dolores Huerta or somebody like that, I mean, forget it. They just don't exist. So I really wanted to counteract that vanishing of the women by doing this book. And I thought, this is going to be really important, I hope, and serve as a model for many, many, I hope, young women to be inspired to see wow, look at my history. Ooh, I've done a lot of resistance. A lot of resistance history is in here. Not just women, you know, getting to be whatever, pretty or important or something, but women who are resisting the racism, resisting the injustice.
And in telling this social history that you grew up with and felt inspired with throughout your entire life, you employ photographs, you have a bilingual text, you have visual images that you worked to research, gather. What are the advantages of this approach to telling social history about Chicanas?
The first book, the first Chicano history book, taught me that images, pictures, means so much to young people. I mean, much more than just reading a text. Not that that doesn't help some, but those pictures were everything. They saw themselves there, they saw their ancestors there, they saw their uncles and aunts and grandfathers there, and saw them doing things that were inspiring. And so I think the reality of a photograph, which I always have believed in, going way back to when I was working with photography earlier at the Museum of Modern Art in New York and da-da-da, and other photography books, I've always believed in the power of the image to move people, to make them see themselves somewhere in a way that just words alone cannot do. So this had to be the same kind of book, pictures, pictures, pictures.
And was there one picture in particular that started the whole process of this book? That's what I've heard from some of your college speeches that you've given already.
Yes. I'd like to say this book was born in Orange County. Whew. Okay. Orange County, California, that is. Okay. Anyway, because actually the very first photograph that I obtained, it was obtained for me by Mary Pardo, a professor at Cal State Northridge, who somehow managed to get from the San Quentin archives a picture of Modesta Davila, who in mid-18th century, after the U.S. had taken over California, they started to build a railroad through her property in Southern California. And she didn't like that at all. What is this railroad? And so she got some big heavy boards and laid them across the tracks that had been put there. And she put a sign on the boards saying, if you want to build a railroad here, you have to pay me. This is my land. Oh. So anyway, she was. This was not approved of. Obviously, the railroad company managed to get her arrested and have a suit against her. And she went to court in Orange County. And they sent her off to prison for blocking the railroad. And she went off to San Quentin Prison. Ooh, way up there, and died there at the age of 26 in the 1850s. So Orange County was first on my map, and the very first picture I got was from Mary Pardo, was a mugshot of her in San Quentin, which is in the book. And so that's why I like to say this book was born in Orange County, because, hey, if something can be born in Orange County that shakes the world, what more can you ask?
Now, let's talk about those 500 years. Let's talk about those 500 years of history. I think that history tends to get more obscured the further back you go. So this book starts out with women in pre-Columbian Mexico, and it goes right through the conquest. That's the first section. We see two principal women figures in that time, La Virgen de Guadalupe and La Malinche. And they're both in the book, but I think what people would really learn a lot about is about women in pre-Columbian Mexica society and how they resisted and what historical roles they played during the conquest and the period after the conquest of Mexico.
Well, that was what I was so excited to discover. There's a number of examples in the book of women, 1680, you know, and 1692. I mean, I can name them. They're in the book, and they organize people, other women often, to rise up and do all kinds of things. There was the famous corn riot in Mexico City when thousands of women went out on the streets and demanded corn for food, and they all have names attached and dates. I mean, these are not just, you know, legends with unknown dates and people. So Juana Burro, okay, and others. So it was really exciting to uncover these women and give them and include their names, the dates, and what they did. So we had to start there. And that was after the conquest. Before that, the main example given before that is, there's two of them, but one of them is the women who, when the Spanish invaded, climbed up on the roofs of the buildings in Tenochtitlan, which became Mexico City. The roofs were flat, and they went up on the roofs, and they threw rocks down on the Spanish soldiers as they marched by. Ha, ha, ha. So much for you. Anyway, and so there's just, all sorts of wonderful stories about resistance. And the reason I think it's so important to include those is because that's the very beginning of the unraveling of the stereotype of the Chicana or Latina as the modest, eyelash-bashing, male-serving, I don't have an opinion of my own kind of image that's been, or stereotype that's been portrayed so much. And these women, none of them were like that.
In reading your book, one of the things that the historical telling follows our history together as a people with things like the Mexican Revolution, the so-called repatriations in U.S. history, the period of struggle against desegregation and Chicano movement into today's immigrant rights marches. And what we learned from this book is what women were doing through all those pivotal moments of our history through a people. Now, people who may have more chauvinistic views of history might just say, well, they were along for the ride. But what do we learn about Chicanas and their historical roles in our history as a people?
Well, they certainly weren't just along for the ride. They did many, many, many kinds of action from organizing to free prisoners from jail, from going on organizing strikes as workers, from many kinds of examples like that, which were not necessarily even suggested by men. These were often organized strictly by women alone doing the action, and that happens over and over again. And I think that you also have you mentioned the Mexican Revolution. The Mexican Revolution never would have succeeded as it did without the soldaderas. Not just the fighters, but the soldaderas, who were the women who actually played the role that in today's armies, there's whole sections of people, of soldiers who do this, right? They do the cooking, they get the uniforms, all the infrastructure of the military is dependent on those. But at the time, the Mexican army had no such units, no people assigned to feed, provide uniforms, do medical work. And so there was no such. So the women did it, and all the soldaderas did it. And sometimes there's a tendency to call them, people who were just following the troops, But actually, they were very, very tough women who organized themselves and did all the work that I just mentioned, which is today done, by men or in the army. And without the soldaderas, there would not have been any success. Of course, there was also the fighters, and plenty of women were out there with guns fighting. Some of them dressed up like men, disguised themselves as men, and became officers in the military at the time also. So they had both kinds of roles. But I wanted to emphasize the soldaderas because they're not understood as well as they should be. We see the brave woman with a gun, and that's true. They were there, but also the soldaderas made it possible to keep going, and that's always been the case. I wanted to mention one other person before this, which was in the struggle of Mexican independence against Spain. Mexico, fought for independence from Spain from 1810 to 1821. And there was a woman, many women in that struggle. But the one I want to mention most is Gertrudis Bocanegra, who was from Pátzcuaro, Michoacán. And she was a fighter from the beginning, She protested when she saw some people beating an Indian who hadn't done his work or something. So her husband and son were both killed in the War of Independence. So when that happened, she said, well, I have to do something. And so she organized a secret underground network of supplies, which consisted of primarily women passing along ammunition, food, medical supplies, messages, everything to from underground, right, from one base of the independence movement to another. And she did that, right, very successfully. It was a very important thing to be doing. And finally, of course, she was captured and tortured to reveal the rest of the network and the names and who was who and who, where was who. And she absolutely refused to do that. And so she was executed in 1817 because she refused to reveal that network. But Jesús Bocanegra, I think, stands out as a very important figure who did so much, died for the cause, and her death was not untypical. Other women were also executed in the same way. But Gertrudis was always sort of my favorite.
We've talked about a lot of different periods of our history as a people, and we've talked about how women have been front and center in these struggles. But I want to bring the discussion a little bit to something a little bit more contemporary, the Chicano movement that was typified in the late 60s. When I first heard about your book, I just thought to myself, what a wonderful antidote to the kind of triumvirate image, male image of the Chicano movement that we all are exposed to and learn, you know, leaders like Corky Gonzalez and Jose Angel Gutierrez. So, yeah. And going off of that, Chicano movement history is obscured by traditional history, and you won't learn about it in U.S. history, but if it is mentioned at all, there's that very dominant male image of it. So what I wanted to ask is, you know, let's talk about what are your thoughts concerning sexism, even within the history of a social movement like the Chicano movement?
Okay. Well, you're right. First of all, you're right. It's been there always. It's always been there. And I'm glad to say I think it's diminished somewhat today as a result of a lot of resistance to it, particularly from young Chicanas. And they've been really opposing it and affirming their strength and their, you know, their right to be in leadership, their right to speak out. And that's been a long struggle. And some of those women, I think, are just wonderful examples of courage in the face of a ongoing kind of either the attitude is patronizing or openly sexist. It ranges, right, in its intensity. But I think that all those forms are harmful. They weaken our struggle as a whole. You know, I used to, when I was in New Mexico, I'd run around and say, it's just like putting half your guns in the closet. Oh, okay, so that was my little sing. Men who oppose women playing, you know, a really major role. It's just like putting half of your guns in the closet. What's the matter with you? Anyway, so, and because we had it in New Mexico, too. Although, New Mexico, possibly more than almost any other area, northern New Mexico had examples of strong women that went back. And when I was there, working there, doing the newspaper there, El Grito del Norte, out of Española, in northern New Mexico, I remember seeing or feeling that a lot of the women there in the north, mostly in rural areas or small villages, you know, reminded me of women in the rural, of African-American women in the rural south in Mississippi that I had met when I went there in 1964 and other times as a member of the Black Civil Rights Movement. And women like Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, who was a terrific example, but there was women in northern New Mexico like her, the same spirit, the same kind of tough, don't mess with me attitude, without being, you know, nasty or anything. No, don't mess with me. Okay. So I remember feeling that women like, the women I met in northern New Mexico reminded me more of the women I had met in rural Mississippi than any other comparison, that I could make. And it was very exciting to find them there. And there was a lot of them. And, of course, they were also up against, you know, patriarchal attitudes. But they just went on organizing, and they just went on doing things. And so I was just very inspired by them and their example. And it was interesting because there was a famous example of an underground resistance organization in Mexico, in New Mexico, that was rumored to be led by a woman. Okay, and so when I got there, I found there was a sort of a remarkable, almost automatic tendency to respect me in northern New Mexico, which wasn't always that swift to be manifested elsewhere. And of course, I did have a higher level of education than many of the women there, but and I was putting out a newspaper and all that. But I really felt that there's a tradition here of strong women that I can work with and work from. So that was really inspiring. Since then, you know, working more in California with Chicanas there, who I've encouraged to, you know, speak out and da 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 da, and they have done so. I would say the situation is about 30% better today than certainly in the '70s, and that's due to a lot of protests by Chicanas, not willing to take that patriarchy.
Now we could 500 years of Chicana women's history could be hours of conversations, but I do want to wrap this engaging conversation that we're having right now with this last question about what this book hopes to accomplish for a young woman, for a young Chicana person out there who may not have been exposed to any of this history at all. What do you hope that person, that young Chicana, would take away from reading your book?
I think, first of all, a kind of new self-respect. She finds herself in history, and it's real, and it can't be denied, and it's there, and there's the pictures to prove it. So that's one thing. And then I think also, number two, of course, one hopes for her to be activated, you know, to become active in the struggle for social justice and to want to, you know, follow in those footsteps as much as possible, or to look around and see what is it right now in her surroundings that enrages her the way it did women in the past in the book, and that she has to fight against. And that's so important, I think, because, well, I have a strong belief in healthy rage or healthy outrage, because without it, man, I don't know if we're going to do very much. We've got to have healthy outrage down the line for the women and as well as the men. And so that's what I hope a young woman would get out of it. And I have seen it happen, actually, in one or two women as they look through the book. And one of them, one of them looked through the book, and I talked to her a few stories. And then she stopped, and she just started to cry. Oh, I said, why are you crying? Tell me. And she said, it's just so moving. It's so moving to see my predecessors, my ancestors, what they've done, and to feel, yeah, I could do it too.
Elizabeth Batita Martinez, legendary Chicana activist. Her latest book is 500 Years of Chicana Women's History, speaking to Uprising producer Gabriel San Roman. She's going to be speaking today at 2:45 p.m. at Anaheim High School at the College and Career Center at 811 West Lincoln Avenue from 2:45 to 4 p.m. And then at Soul Art Gallery Cafe, 511 East Santana Boulevard in Santana at 8 p.m. And then tomorrow at UC Riverside, the Commons Room, 355 900 University Avenue, from 2 to 3:30 p.m. If you missed that, we'll put that on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today.